Alice Miller is a Swiss psychiatrist who has, after 20 years of practicing psychiatry, quit to write. And the reason she quit to write was because she was finding similar patterns in all the people she was seeing. The people she tended that were showing up for therapy were generally bright, many of them fairly successful people, professional people a lot, who tended to be complaining of the same kinds of things, of chronic severe depression, a lot of fear and anxiety, lots of things like that. And she started seeing the same kinds of patterns coming out in the same kinds of people. And so she started looking at it real closely to see how things...
She lives in Switzerland?
Yeah, she's Swiss, yeah.
And she's probably just dealing with the Swiss people in that country. There's no foreigners coming in to see her.
No, probably, no, there were Swiss people, but her issue certainly relates heavily to everybody in Western society. That's the point she makes in her book.
What I know about Switzerland, it's a little bit different than the modern society.
Yeah, I mean, societally it might be, but in terms of some of the issues around parents and children and all of that, Western culture seems to have similar patterns all the way through, which is her point in these books. And the purpose of this session is just to introduce some of you to these books, which I have found to be sort of the same kind of task we've been at in the Bible study in terms of finding good ways to describe and define what's going on out there around us. And often in the Christian tradition, psychology, psychoanalysis, things like that have somehow been, sometimes actually been spoken of with a great deal of distaste and things like that. The Christian people shouldn't have to deal in any depth with psychological problems and things like that. One thing that I'm always reminded of, this is something Mary Hinderly told me once, that Christians can benefit from psychotherapy more than others, because you know the psychoanalytic task is to strip away. You know, you unpeel and unpeel and unpeel and unpeel and unpeel. And if there's no point of resilience for you at the bottom of all that unpeeling, all you can do is keep going. And one of the wonderful gifts that's been given to Christian people is that point of resiliency. That is, what are we? We're people of hope. It's been given into us, like in the Bible study this morning in Romans 8, how, you know, we have that kind of hope. So therefore the process can be one of healing and getting rid of some of the garbage so that you're able to see. And I believe that in the secular world that there's a whole lot of folk out there that are doing some helpful descriptions of the reality of the world that allows us to face some of that stuff and be able to deal then for us in a very faithful way. And I found these books this last year to be very helpful, not just for myself personally, but also in terms of helping folk that I deal with a lot, and not just in my parish, but friends as well, in talking about some of the problems that are facing us in contemporary society, especially around how in the world we get to love ourselves and to help other people do the same thing. And one thing I really like about Alice Miller is, she probably wouldn't like this if I said it, but I think that what she's talking about in her books has a great deal to do with the gospel itself. Because one thing she says that's happened in Western culture is that because of the behavior patterns demanded of children from parents, that all of us grow up with a real sense of fear about how we behave. And I'm not talking about learning how to live responsibly in society here. I'm just talking about the fear that if you do such and such, you're going to lose such and such. If you do this, your parents are going to abandon you. If you do such and such, other people will. Those kinds of fears that are very common in Western culture. And what happens, what gets squelched in the human person then, is freedom and vitality. Those are her words. She said, that's what we're losing in human people, is freedom and vitality. And when I first read that, I said, well, that's how I understand what the gospel's about. That's exactly what God gives us. Think of all the words all through the New Testament, that God liberates us from sin and death, all the words about freedom. We're free in Christ. Read the book of Galatians sometime. Hear what St. Paul has to say about that. That's what happens for us in God. Vitality, to have life, to live in the wholeness and fullness of life. You know, and to really have a hold on that, to be vital and free. And that's what she's getting at in these books and for Western culture. And it's certainly something that we proclaim as Christian people that belongs as the gift that God gives in Jesus Christ, is to be free and vital, even in the midst of some of the horrors of the world. So there's all that. She has four books that she's written. She's only been writing since 1979, so this is a fairly new kind of thing, and I'll share some of the things from you. And like I said, a lot of this is just introductory for her, so you can read. These are not easy books to read. I'll share that with you right now. They're not, this ain't pop psychology. This isn't, how to feel good in 5 minutes. Actually, they will probably make you feel absolutely hideous if you tackle them. Guaranteed. Oh, no. But I think she's writing a lot of true things. The first one is called The Drama of the Gifted Child. It's only about 90 pages long, but is pretty powerful. And in a library, you may find it, find an old copy, you may find it under the title Prisoners of Childhood. It's subtitled, in this edition, How Narcissistic Parents Form and Deform the Emotional Lives of Their Talented Children. This is not meant to put parents off. One thing Alice Miller does beautifully is she lays no blame anywhere, except for on the ways in which we've all been enculturated by our society. So if you are a parent, this is not going to be a terrifying book to read, just for that. I mean, you're not going to come out of reading this book feeling, oh my word, what have I done to my children? You know, she won't do that to you. Probably more likely, she will call you into your own childhood and think more about what happened to you as a child and how that's been echoed and mirrored in your parenting of your children. And it's not, she's very good at doing that. And in the current edition that's out, you may find it, the subtitle is now The Search for the True Self. And we don't know, some of us are looking at this, maybe think the publisher got chickened out or something with the other subtitle. But The Search for the True Self is also a very good title, subtitle, for the book, and I'll tell you a little bit that more. The second one deals with a topic that is of extreme interest in our culture today. And the book is called For Your Own Good, and the subtitle is Hidden Cruelty in Child Rearing and the Roots of Violence. And in this one, she tackles the whole issue of abuse to children, physical abuse to children, and what some of the roots of it are in our culture. And this is a book that's being used a great deal right now by people who are involved in dealing with children who have been in abusive situations. It's exceptional. One thing that she deals with in here, in great detail and great length, is with Adolf Hitler and his life. And it's not just a simplistic kind of Hitler did all those bad things because he was abused as a child. It's not that simple. She does, and somebody mentioned to me another time when I was talking about this, that this is probably one of the only sympathetic treatments of Hitler as a human being that they had read. And those of you that have been in the Bible studies, given back when we were talking about anger and hatred and some of that stuff, remember we were talking, and Jesus saying, love your enemies and all that, and we talked a lot about World War II and hating, and although however awful Hitler was a human being. And Alice Miller does a wonderful job of dealing with the trauma of Hitler's life and the way that got echoed and mirrored then in what Germany was doing in a very sympathetic way. So it's not, I'm guaranteeing you that I'm not offering you real fun, delightful reading. I'm offering you challenging reading that may allow you to think carefully about some of the things that are going on in our society. The third book is called Thou Shalt Not Be Aware, Society's Betrayal of the Child. And this is an exceptional book for those of us that are part of the Judeo-Christian tradition, because she takes that on full bore. And the ways in which the church has, in many ways, I believe, sort of rearranged the real theological precepts of what God gives us in the gospel in order to control people. And I'm going to read some selections from this, and you can see sort of what I'm meaning. And some of it, some of this is also, I keep saying it's all hard to read. It is all hard to read. I mean, not just difficult because of vocabulary and stuff. That's not the issue. They're very well written, and they've been, she writes in German, and they've been very well translated. So they're not like some translations you read that are kind of, gee, I wish we had could read this in the original language. These are really exceptionally well translated. So they're good to read. But they're very hard to read because you have to face some facts that maybe we wouldn't want to face. There's a fourth book as well, and it's called Pictures of a Childhood. I don't own it because I can't afford it yet. But you might find it in the library or something, and it's kind of a coffee table book, but it's not the kind of thing you might want to have over your evening coffee. Alice Miller, when she she figured out at one point, after she read Drama of the Gifted Child, that perhaps she should maybe deal with some of these issues herself around her own childhood and look at her own issues around freedom and vitality. And what she started doing was painting, which was something she'd never been allowed to do as a child because she was being directed other ways when she wanted to paint. And one of the one of her watercolors is on the cover of this book. And they're very interesting. And Pictures from a Childhood is a whole series of her watercolors with her commentary at the beginning. There's also another article, and I have a copy here. And if anybody's interested, I left it in my room though. If anybody's interested in a brief synopsis of her position, I'd be glad to have it copied for you here. It came from a recent issue of a book of a magazine called The Art of Mothering. So if anybody ever sees that magazine, it's the issue in sometime in the spring, April or May or something like that. But if you're interested in getting a copy, I can get you one here as well. So those are the books, and I just want to try and, like I said, this is an attempt. I'm trying to work this. You're all guinea pigs, after a fashion. If you heard the Yemmer story, maybe we don't want to talk about that too closely yesterday. But of dealing with this stuff for the church in a theological fashion, because I believe that, and Barb and Margo, I hope, and Sharon, I hope you'd back me up in this, that Alice Miller is writing a very accurate description of the problems besetting people in Western culture. And I think all of you know, I think you may have experienced it yourself or know people, but know the problems of depression in our time. There are an awful lot of depressed people out there. An awful lot of depressed people. And Alice Miller's point is that has some real roots in the way our society has dealt with people, and that we need to do it. Anyway, we would agree that it's accurate. It's accurate. She's accurate in her descriptions. What you do with it, that's what, in another thing we did it, is you get all this out here, and then you have to say, what do you do with it? And that's the kind of thing I'm starting to explore, and I'm trying to do that by, I hope, describing well her positions. In the drama, The Gifted Child, I need to point out that when she talks about gifted here, we're not talking about prodigies. We're not talking about super intelligent people. The gifted child for Alice Miller is simply the child that has the intelligence and the sensitivity to be able to pick up immediately on the needs, wishes, and desires of their parent. And her point is that all of us, in the first 6 months of our lives, at least, that is the only time in our entire lives when we have every right to demand everybody's full and undivided attention. That in the first 6 months of your life, that was a time when whatever you wanted, you can get. Whatever you feel like, you can act out. You know, there's absolutely no restrictions on that. when you cry, you should be able to cry. You know, I mean, that's it. And everybody should be paying attention, that's involved in your care, should be paying attention to you. Her point is that Western culture has disallowed that for all of us in our infancy. Now, maybe some of us have been more fortunate than others in getting that kind of attention from a parent. But her point is that most parents didn't get that. And so what they find then in the child is a way to meet their needs. Now, I'm not talking about 13-year-old girls having babies so that they have something to love. She's talking about the normal process of people having children and when they're generally adults and things like that. And so both the parents' fear of loss and abandonment that they felt when they were a child gets acted out in their care for the child. So that is, they want the child to stop crying because they don't want the child to cry. So you condition the child to cry at certain times so you know what's happening. They want the child to be, you know, independent at certain times. So very often things like toilet training get forced on children maybe at an earlier age than might be appropriate. They want the child to eat at certain times and do that. And the child should be able to respond lovingly to the parent when the parent needs that kind of loving support. And the intelligent, sensitive child will pick up on that immediately. Immediately. From Alice Miller claims from the, you know, very first moments of a life, will pick up that if the mother or the father or whoever the caregiver is, that the, because what the child needs then, right, is that person. The child is not going to live if that person's not going to take care of it. The child will die. We're talking about death earlier, and she makes the point actually that our, you know, no notion that we can die is with us from the very beginning, and. So if the parent doesn't take care of the child's going to die or lose the parent or be abandoned or all those kinds of things. And all those feelings are part of being human from the earliest. I think she's making a wonderful case for original sin here. If you want a good case for the church, she's got a great one here. So the infant learns almost immediately that I had better only cry when the need can be met. If I cry at another time, I may be abandoned. If I don't eat when it's appropriate for me to eat, then I may not get fed at all. All these kinds of issues, and that these happen in early age. And then it goes on from there, and we all know about the varieties of ways in which the behavior of children is controlled by parents. Of course, always the really difficult fine line here is something we deal with in my parish from time to time in terms of controlling the behavior of children and what's appropriate and what isn't appropriate, in that we have a lot of kids. What do we have? 45 kids under 10. It's wonderful. It's just the entire 6.5 years I've been there has always been a pregnant person. You know, we had one, it got iffy there last spring, but somebody pulled through at the last minute, you know. We've been meaning to put a sign outside the parish that said, you know, if you want to, we maybe even charging a fee for people, because we've had two couples that I know of that had been trying for years to get pregnant, and they came one Sunday to Faith Lutheran, and bingo, you know? So, I mean, we thought maybe we could provide a service or something, or charge a fee, or I don't know, whatever the deal is, but it seems to be, or put a sign up, you know, beware, you know, if you're a young married person or something, you don't wish to be pregnant, don't come to this parish. You may be in trouble. But, so we have a lot of little kids. And it's really fun, and they all feel at home there. They like being there. They enjoy it. They have ownership of the place. They're not afraid of it. On the other hand, on Sunday morning, in church, in the worship service, if we had one of those a couple weeks ago, were you there? When it was 2 weeks ago, when it was one of those Sundays when every child did one bizarre act.
Right,
yeah. Yeah, they're really wound up, and that happens occasionally. And all it takes is one bizarre act from each child, right? And then, whenever that happens, the whole issue of what is the appropriate behavior for children in church comes up. And all the older people start saying, well, when we went to church with our kids, they sat and behaved, and if they moved a muscle, they were in trouble. And all the younger parents are saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, these kids feel at home here, and so what if it gets a little noisy from time to time? But on the other hand, they're feeling terribly guilty because some of the older people are upset because the kids are making noise and they can't hear what's going on. And every time that happens, we end up with this conversation. And we don't know if there's a solution yet. And Alice Miller raises that same question. And what is? I mean, is it most appropriate that the child feels free enough to stand up and walk down the pew and get out in the aisle and go up and say hi to the pastor? That's happened on a couple occasions. Well, you know, and the poor mother or father is chasing the child down the aisle going, oh, feeling terrible. Or is it more appropriate that the minute that child stands up, the parent has the kid sit down? It's both, isn't it? You know, the child needs to learn how to be a responsible, sensitive part of society that looks out for the needs of other people. At which point, then, the noisy behavior is inappropriate, right? On the other hand, the child needs to feel comfortable to express itself, and especially in that place. I don't know what the answer is, but Alice Miller gets us into some of the things, and maybe we need to err more on the side of the freedom for a while till we figure out how one find better ways of teaching children how to be responsible people of society, sensitive to the needs of other people. So that's just one example of some of the problems she raised. But I'd like to read a few. You know, and feel free to jump in all the time, as always. One point she makes is that what happens when the children who have experienced this as infants and little children grow up is that they become absolutely terrified of what may be their true self, of expressing that. And another place in the scripture and of our call as Christians that always comes to me when I read Alice Miller now is Jesus' command to love our neighbor as ourselves. You know, there is, in that, inherent is the fact that we are called to love ourselves. Beginning, of course, in the fact that God loves us. You know, we have a nice starting point for that, but we are called to love ourselves. And when you can start loving yourself, you are more able to be confident in being out there with other folk, right? Because you know you're not going to get knocked down or whatever. One of Alice Miller's little things is that finding that true self and then the freedom of vitality there. She writes this, "For the majority of sensitive people, the true self remains deeply and thoroughly hidden. But how can you love something then you do not know, something that has never been loved?" You know, if we're called to love ourselves, and your true self's really hidden down there under all this other stuff that you've been trying to behave properly out there, how can you love something you don't know, something that's never been loved? So it is that many gifted person lives without any notion of his or her true self. Such people are enamored of an idealized, conforming, false self. They will shun their hidden and lost true self unless depression makes them aware of its loss, or psychosis confronts them harshly with the true self whom they now have to face, to whom they are delivered up helplessly as to a threatening stranger. That is, she's saying that since parents never would, by their own, not really by their fault, but by all they knew, disallowed the child from expressing the child's true self, then the true self becomes so totally hidden that we end up with this, with a false kind of thing. Another thing, and this fits in with the Bible studies we've been doing, she talks about, is what also gets lost is our ability to express our feelings. That also goes away. She says that one serious consequence of this early adaptation, that's adapting to the parents' wants and needs, is the impossibility of consciously experiencing certain feelings of one's own, such as jealousy, envy, anger, loneliness, anxiety, either in childhood or later in adulthood. And she said, this is all the more tragic since we are here concerned with lively people who are especially capable of differentiated feelings. So she makes the point that all of us are end up with that kind of thing. Then she talks about what she thinks healthy self-feeling should be, which is also a helpful thing. She says, I understand a healthy self-feeling to mean the unquestioned certainty that the feelings and wishes one experiences are a part of oneself. This is just the same kind of stuff we've been talking about in Bible study this week, isn't it? That when you feel fearful, it's okay. You know, that fear is really what you're feeling. If when grief's happening, no matter what the situation is, whether it's a death or a divorce or some other kind of loss, that's okay. It's okay for you to feel that at that particular moment. And she says the certainty of knowing that, of experiencing those feelings, she says, is not something one can gain upon reflection. In other words, you just can't sort of sit around and say, well, now I'm going to experience my true feelings today, and what are we, you know, it doesn't quite work that way. It is there like one's own pulse, she said, which one does not notice as long as it functions normally. But occasionally you take your pulse, right? It's still there. And that's the kind of thing that she's getting at. Okay, here's what she has said about vitality and freedom and depression. And more about good feeling. She says, the true opposite of depression is not gaiety or absence of pain. Okay? That's really important. But vitality. The freedom to experience spontaneous feeling. That is, if you're feeling something painful, like grief, that doesn't have to be a depressive feeling. It's expressive, right? It's the opposite of that. It's that in getting to your true self, then you have the freedom to experience that feeling in its depth. It's back to what Barry was talking about Sunday night. You know, that whether or not we really experience things. He was asking that. If we get an experience of grace, are we really free enough to sink into that, really experience that thing? And that's what she's saying that this allows us to do. We can get rid of the outer shell of things. Says it is part of the kaleidoscope of life that these feelings are not only cheerful, beautiful, and good. They can also display the whole scale of human experience, including envy, jealousy, rage, disgust, greed, despair, and mourning. But this freedom cannot be achieved, she said, if the childhood roots are cut off. For a person with narcissistic problems, that is always concentrating on yourself, access to the true self is thus only possible when that person no longer has to be afraid of the intense emotional world of his early childhood. So it's getting in touch with some of that stuff. She also talks about, here's some things about the depressive character of our society. She said, depression is a disease of our time. Anyway, she says that. I don't want to read this whole thing. Depression is a disease of our time. We all agree with that. That's fine. She gives an example also. She has some really good examples, some of which are really painful. And there's a good one later, too. This is a bad one. Some of the things that she's noticed, and she said, of ways in which parents can control what their children want or don't want. And she says this. I went out for a walk. I find this to be a terribly sad story, although it seems really small. Went out for a walk and noticed a young couple a few steps ahead, both tall. They had a little boy with them, about 2 years old, who was running alongside and whining. We are accustomed to seeing such situations from the adult point of view, but here I want to describe it as it was experienced by the child. The two had just bought themselves ice cream bars on sticks from the kiosk and were licking them with enjoyment. The little boy wanted one too. His mother said affectionately, "Look, you can have a bite of mine. A whole one is too cold for you." The child did not want just one bite, but held out his hand for the whole ice, which his mother took out of his reach again. He cried in despair, and soon exactly the same thing was repeated with his father. "There you are, my pet," his father said affectionately. "You can have a bite of mine." "No, no," cried the child, and ran ahead again, trying to distract himself. Soon he came back again and gazed enviously and sadly up at the two grown-ups who were enjoying their ice creams contentedly and at one. Time and again he held out his little hand for the whole ice cream bar, but the adult hand with its treasure was withdrawn again. The more the child cried, the more it amused his parents. It made them laugh a lot, and they hoped to humor him along with their laughter, too. "Look, it isn't so important. What a fuss you are making." Once the child sat down on the ground and began to throw little stones over his shoulder in his mother's direction, but then he suddenly got up again and looked around anxiously, making sure that his parents were still there. When his father had completely finished his ice cream, he gave the stick to the child and walked on. The little boy licked that big bit of wood, expectantly looked at it, threw it away, wanted to pick it up again, but did not do so, and a deep sob of loneliness and disappointment shook his small body. Then he trotted obediently after his parents. It's a really sad story when it's put that way. But it's not uncommon. that's a very, you know, okay, this, it's not good for the child to have the whole ice cream bar, so we eat our whole, and he, but, you know, how to deal with that. And instead, you have this poor child. Like, what she says about that, it was, is narcissistic. She writes that, she writes this. She said, it seemed clear to me that this little boy was not being frustrated in his oral drives. You know, she makes a lot, she really puts down some of the, some psychological things. For he was given ample opportunity to take a bite.
But he was frustrated otherwise.
That's right. It was his narcissistic...
Very bad, the trauma for
him. Hmm? Yes, right.
Very bad.
And what she says is it was his narcissistic needs that were constantly being wounded and frustrated. His wish to hold the ice cream stick in his hand like the others was not understood. Worse still, it was laughed at. They made fun of his needs. He was faced with two giants who were proud of being consistent and also supported each other, while he, quite alone in his distress, obviously could say nothing beyond no, nor could he make himself clear to his parents with his gestures, which were very expressive. He had no advocate. And that is one thing she says. Also, she says it gets to be, well, I'll finish reading this next paragraph too. I think it gets into the whole issue that she's discussing here. Why, indeed, did these parents behave with so little empathy? Why didn't one of them think of eating a little quicker, or even of throwing away half his ice cream and giving the child his stick with a bit of edible substance? Why did they both stand there laughing, eating so slowly, and showing so little concern about the child's obvious distress? They were not unkind or cold parents. The father spoke to the child very tenderly. Nevertheless, at least at this moment, they displayed a lack of empathy. We can only solve this riddle if we manage to see the parents, too, as insecure children, children who have at last found a weaker creature, and in comparison with him, they now can feel very strong. What child has never been laughed at for his fears and been told, you don't need to be afraid of a thing like that? And what child will then not feel shamed and despised because he could not assess the danger correctly? And will that little person not take the next opportunity to pass on these feelings to a still smaller child? Such experiences come in all shades and varieties. Common to them all is the sense of strength that it gives the adult to face the weak and helpless child's fear, and to have that possibility of controlling fear in another person while he cannot control his own. And I think that's a very true description of just how we function a lot in society. Anyway, and I think we're all that way to a certain extent. I mean, I know I certainly am. I'm not even a parent. It's probably a good thing I'm not. But I know in myself that moment when you know very well that you have power over a weaker person to deal with something you can't deal with yourself. And I think we all know that moment to a certain extent. Maybe some of you are just really super people who never, ever do that. I hope so. I really hope so. But anybody, whoever, especially if you ever get in a powerful position of any kind, even chairing a committee in your church, you can exercise that power. And I know I do it as a pastor. I know I do it. You know, and then I feel, for a few moments until I figure it out, which Alice Mills has been helping me do too, you feel terrific for a moment. Boy. While the other person sort of crawls away with their tail between their legs going, hey, we've got this all worked out now. And then all of a sudden you realize, wait a minute, you know, that was totally inappropriate. In fact, in my my book, I wrote a name in the margin about that, what child has never been laughed at for his fears and been told you don't need to be afraid of a thing like that. And I remembered a situation very well here at Holden in a Bible study once, back when in the winter community. And a woman, a very capable, bright, wonderful woman in the Bible study said, we were talking about different things, and she said, I really want to get at what this faith means. And she said, she's a very articulate woman also, and she said, but I'm just not a good theologian. You know, and of course, I leaped right into that as being wonderful affirming pastor to tell her what a good theologian she really was. At which point she left the Bible study in tears. I wasn't being empathetic to her need at all. I was pulling a wonderful power trip on her saying, here, let me make it all better and tell you exactly what you need. She needed to say, I'm not a good theologian. And to do that, to express that, to be that, to be weak at that point, to do that, and then go on from there. That was her need. Our relationship was never the same after that. And I'm just understanding what happened now, you know, 10 years later. So, is there hope? We all say there maybe there's hope here at some point. I want to read a positive story along those same lines to get the other side of it. And somebody talk about something because I have to find it. I think it's in here. Is it making some sense? Are you understanding what she's getting at? And I think it's a painful kind of reality she's describing for us, because I think we all know the patterns that...
I can say something while you're looking.
Yeah, thank you.
Kind of illustrates how that whole process works.
Yeah.
As a recent graduate with a master's degree in social work, the expectation, of course, is Zoom, go into a professional position, make money, and be famous and big shot and family and all this stuff. My experience has been that my degree program was enormously, let's just say it was disemboweling, as far as my motivation to continue in a professional capacity. And so I'm in the, at least in the eyes of the world, the unenviable position of having tripped and fallen along that golden path that has been laid out for me. And so I found myself in a position of having those giants, those adult people there, telling me one thing, and my knowing darn well I'm in a different position than they see me as being in. And that through my growth in faith and through Christ's presence and healing with me, and certainly coming out of this holy community, that it really is, I have the strength to say, no, this is where I am. God knows that, and I'm sorry that you don't, but it's more important to me that God knows that. Now, little kids, they have that little sophistication as a tool, but somewhere along in my parenting, I was given permission to be, well, you know, maybe I'm not what other people think I ought to be, but I'm really okay just as I am. So at least from my position right now, and from having the very good fortune of having a parent who understood that, affirmed that personhood in me, what Alice Miller is saying is terrifically important and terrifically true. She's a wonderfully healing writer, has a lot of really important things to say. Did you find it?
I found it, yes. Good. Thank you, Barb. That was really helpful. And she said this, which gets along with what Barb was saying, too. She says that the knowledge we need is often quite close at hand, knowledge to get to the other point, other side of these things, even right under our very nose. When we have the chance to observe children of today who are growing up with fewer constraints, and I think we know that. In fact, sometimes that gets back to the issue I was explaining, you know, of the children in my parish. You know, and the older people saying, why can't they keep those kids under control, huh? You know, when I had my kids in church, or when I was taken to church, I always sat up straight, you know, those kinds of things. And I think there are different generational things, and I really think some of those older people sometimes wish that maybe they could have behaved that way in church. We won't get too close to that one. But anyway, but that's true. I think you hear when we talk about things that have to do with church and stuff like that, a lot of people will talk about the kinds of constraints that were present when they were growing up, you know, really tough, strict stuff, and it's hard. Anyway, I'll start again. The knowledge we need is often quite close at hand, even right under our very nose. When we have the chance to observe children of today who are growing up with fewer constraints, we can learn a great deal about the true nature of the emotional life. That is, the children are much freer to express their emotions. That's her point. Which remained hidden for the older generation. To give an example, a mother is at a playground with her 3-year-old who is clinging to, these are always very sad stories too. Who is clinging to her skirt and sobbing as though her heart would break. Marianne refuses to play with the other children. When I ask what the matter is, the mother tells me with great sympathy and understanding for her daughter that they have just come from the train station. The little girl's daddy, whom they had gone to meet, had not been there. Only Ingrid's daddy had gotten off the train. I said to Marianne, oh, but that must be a big disappointment for you. The child looked at me, large tears rolling down her cheeks. But soon she was stealing glances at the other children, and 2 minutes later she was romping happily with them. Because her deep pain was experienced and not bottled up, it could give way to other happier feelings. That's a very simple thing. You know, the mother didn't tell her, oh, come on, your dad will be on the next train. The mother simply let her sob, and Alice Miller tried her lung and named her thing. You must have been very, didn't say, oh, come on, cheer up, said that must be really disappointing. You know, the child was allowed to express the feeling, was allowed to have the feeling named and affirmed, and can experience the whole thing and get on with it, you know. It's a wonderful, wonderful story, and we can pay attention for all those kinds of things. That's the one from For Your Own Good. I'd like to share some things from this book, Thou Shalt Not Be Aware, which I think if we're talking about things in a Christian context provides the most shocking and maybe arguably problematic stuff for us as we deal with things. She talks in this book about something she calls, well, actually she starts in For Your Own Good, talks about something she calls poisonous pedagogy. And she means that in terms of the way in which children have been taught all kinds of things about how they should live in the world. And that she calls it poisonous because she feels it really does poison their potential to grow into healthy people. And she talks, here's some things she talks about from Scripture that become part of our things. She says, can it be that the coercive measure of the poisonous pedagogy would have less power over us and our culture if the Judeo-Christian tradition had not lent them strong support? It is always the Isaacs who sacrifice God, whose sacrifice God demands from the Abrahams, never the other way around. Abraham took Isaac up there. Isaac didn't take Abraham. It is daughter Eve who is punished for not resisting temptation and not suppressing your curiosity out of obedience to God's will. It is the pious and faithful son Job, whom God the Father continues to mistrust until he has proven his faithfulness and subservience by undergoing unspeakable torments. It is Jesus who dies on the cross to fulfill the words of the Father. The psalmist, too, never tire of extolling the importance of obedience as a condition of each and every human life. We have all grown up with this cultural heritage. So here's where she starts. This is the influence of Western culture. But it could not have survived as long as it has if we had not been taught to accept without question the fact that a loving father has the need to torment his son, that the father cannot sense his son's love and therefore, as in the story of Job, requires proof of it. I find this to be extremely disturbing stuff. There would, without any doubt, she writes, be more people capable of love if the church, instead of urging its members to obey authority and expecting allegiance to Christ on these grounds, would under the crucial significance of Joseph's attitude. And I think this is really interesting. And one thing, this is something that was very affirming for me, because I like to preach on Joseph at Christmas time. Because poor Joseph, I mean, he's really ignored. You know, he sort of just sits there in the background, does all these nice things for Mary and the kid, and we just kind of, you know, he's the one that, you know, in the Christmas play, Mary always gets, in the Christmas pageants, Mary always gets to hold the baby Jesus, right? What does Joseph do? Stands there with a crook and goes. You know, and in most Christmas pageants, doesn't even acknowledge when the shepherds and everybody shows up, you know, just stands there. You know, and if you read Matthew's gospel where Joseph is talked about a whole lot, I mean, Joseph got pretty involved in this whole process. You know, had some wild dreams and all kinds of things. So anyway, Joseph needs to preach on Christmas time, but I like what Alice Miller says. With Joseph's attitude, he served his child because he regarded him as the child of God. Isn't that a nice sentence? She's got some good things to say here about Christianity too. As a child of God, what would it be like if all of us regarded our children as children of God? Which we could do after all, and which we yak about till the cows come home. I mean, that's the big deal these days. In the 1980s, we're all children of God. All kinds of nifty little songs being written about that, talk about that at all these baptisms, we do all this stuff. Her point is, and we talk about that among adults, don't we? How are we supposed to regard all the people of the world? As God's children. What most of us that are a little bit older learn to sing in Sunday school? Jesus loves the little children, all the children of the world. red and yellow, black and white, they were precious. It's like, anyway. And all this stuff, that's all over the place. But it doesn't get acted out with our own children. We talk about being gifts for each other and we do all that stuff. But the point is, you think of Joseph. He served the child as, because regarded as the child of God, and we should all do it. And then she makes a reverse point. She says, in his Christmas message of 1979, in honor of the year of the child, Pope John Paul II said that it is the task of adults to instill ideals in their children. These words coming from a man capable of love are certainly well-intentioned. But when pedagogues, both clerical and secular, set out to instill prescribed ideals in a child, they invariably turn to the methods of poisonous pedagogy, and at best train children to become adults who train others in turn, instead of raising them to becoming loving human beings. Then she says, children who are respected learn respect. Children who are cared for learn to care for those weaker than themselves. Children who are loved for what they are cannot learn intolerance. That's really important. In an environment such as this, they will develop their own ideals, which can be nothing other than humane, since they grow out of the experience of love. Which to me is what we say about the gospel all the time. Where the gospel is preached, then things like love and peace and justice will grow in the hearts and minds of the faithful. We do all that, and that's precisely what she's talking about in terms of our children. Okay, here comes another. Now that was a nice one. Now we'll slip back again and get another heavy-duty one. Are you ready? Sharon goes, oh, no, no, no. She said, we can also take Herod. Oh, here, well, we'll do a good thing first here. Oh, I'll read this. This is this too much reading? Are you all?
No, but Nancy, there's something that's bugging me.
Okay, let it out. That's what it's all about. And let it all hang out.
I don't think it bothers other people, but you know, when we look at pictures of Joseph and Mary and all these stories about them and talking about Jesus being maybe around 12 years old, you know, and teaching in the synagogue, and Joseph taking him to Egypt to keep him from harm and then coming back at that certain time, we see all these pictures or hear all these stories of Joseph, Jesus, and Mary. And yet, in some places in the Bible, unless I'm interpreting it wrong, it sounds like Mary had a lot of other children, too, and that they're brothers and sisters. Mm-hmm. And they kind of gloss over that, except for a certain point later. And I find it very difficult to reconcile the fact that Joseph and Mary were parents to other children and where they fit in and everything else. And I can't accept that.
Well, you can't accept that they had other children.
Yeah, and how do they fit that in with them going to Egypt, coming back, and all the different age things of the things that were happening with Jesus, and you don't hear about the other children or how they're dragging them around?
Well, the only specific thing we hear about other children is that one at the wedding of Cana. It says that Mary and also Jesus, some of Jesus' brothers were there. It also, there's the other place in Mark's gospel where Jesus is in Nazareth and his mother and his brothers want to stop him from making a fool of himself. Remember that story? Yeah, well.
I've always thought it would be better if Mary had just had Jesus.
Well, then the other.
It would be easier to accept Mary in that respect. I mean, it would be easier to accept Mary in that respect than Jesus.
Well, there, you know, the church. Do you want me to, shall I answer that? Do you want me to answer? Should we go down the middle? I'll answer that because I think it might be important. Okay, the church has dealt with that whole issue in several ways. One of the problems that in the New Testament, the other place is in the book of Acts where the apostle James is talked about as being the brother of our Lord, right? Yeah, there's James the elder and James the brother of our Lord. That's how they're distinguished. And the church has dealt with Jesus' family. One of the problems is the Greek word for brother and the Greek word for cousin are the same. Got a problem right there. So it gets translated cousin sometimes, but not in the scriptures. It's more used brother. So one of the church has dealt with that in a lot of ways, and it all depends on, I think, perspective. And one of the places where, for example, the real issue here is the issue of Mary's virginity, okay? And we talk about the virgin birth a lot. The virgin, the Orthodox truly believe in a virgin birth. That is, that when Jesus was born, Mary was still intact, a virgin, okay, after the birth, you know, and that there wasn't any more. Roman Catholics get a little fuzzier on that. And talk about the virgin birth, but then they talk about the fact that Mary had no other children, and that's how they preserve that. But they don't want to do the sort of miracle birth that did, wasn't a real birth stuff. Yeah, they want it to be a real birth, but they don't want Mary to, I think they don't want Mary to have intercourse with Joseph. I think that's the issue. Right. I think this is the real issue in front of us here, folks. Right. The Protestant tradition is that we don't believe in the virgin birth. We believe in the virginal conception. That is, when Jesus was conceived, Mary was a virgin. But that Jesus' birth was a birth exactly like all of ours.
Yeah.
You know, in order to be completely human, you know, the pain experience, the same pain every infant experiences at birth. And we also believe that, that Mary and Joseph did have a normal married life and had other children, which the scriptures attest to in that those
but
places.
But say until after Jesus was born.
Yeah. Yeah, right. But after Jesus was born, yeah, right.
But it's still hard to reconcile.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, everybody sort of got to deal with that one. I like the fact that Mary and Joseph...
They don't really explain it, do they? And we do have to assume then that there were a lot of children of theirs. I don't know.
Why don't you ask him when you get there?
Yeah, good idea. Hey, okay, there we go. Find out. You will all be welcomed by Jesus' family, you know, helping out.
I think it's more or less understood that Joseph was older than she. It's possible he had children by a former marriage.
There's another thing. But you have to remember that the tradition of Joseph being older than Mary comes out of England, medieval England. Doesn't come out. See, the thing is, we're 2,000 years beyond this, and you got to separate. You end up having to separate out what's truth and fiction here, and there's all the traditions and the things that are fun. I mean, the carol about the cherry tree, you know, when Joseph was an old man. Anyway, but that's one of the songs about all that stuff. But that's where, and we get that. That's a very ancient. I mean, not in that form, but a very ancient medieval English carol, and that comes out of that whole thing. And the English love that, you know, about Joseph being ancient and decrepit and. Yeah, it's respectable here in English. Yeah, right. So then, and Joseph, and probably then, you know, you have to pay attention to the fact that maybe Joseph wasn't able to deal with Mary, you know. So if he's an old man, I don't know. There's all kinds of ways that, you know, but then we have to look back at Abraham, you know, which St. Paul said was almost dead when he conceived his son.
Was an old man,
right. Anyway, so that's off our subject a little bit, but thank you for raising it, and we talk about that. It's interesting. But here's some more stuff that has to do with the Christmas story from Alice Miller. In the history of art, the massacre of children has been depicted over and over again. Let us take as an example King Herod's slaying of all the male children in his realm. He feels threatened by them because there may be among them the new king who will one day vie for his throne. And for this reason, he brings about a bloodbath in Bethlehem by ordering every boy aged 2 or under to be killed. Mary and Joseph flee to Egypt in order to save their child. Their love not only saves Jesus' life, it also enables the riches of his soul to unfold, which ultimately leads to his early death. One could rightly claim that it was Jesus' authenticity that caused his death, from which a false conformist self would have saved him. But can a meaningful life be measured quantitatively? Would Jesus have been happier if his parents, instead of treating him with love and respect, had raised him from an early age to be a faithful subject of Herod or live a long life as a scribe? The fact that Jesus grew up with parents whose only goal was to love and respect him can hardly be denied, not even by believing Christians, who in accordance with their religious traditions see in Jesus the Son of God. Every year, one thing I find very interesting, Alice Miller, it's hard to tell whether or not she's Christian or not, but she capitalizes all the pronouns related to Jesus all the way through. I don't know whether that's a culturally stylistic thing. Anyway, interesting. Every year throughout the Christian world, the child is honored in the celebration of Christmas. Yes, yet Christian pedagogy has never been guided by this. Even someone who assumes that Jesus owes his capacity for love, his authenticity and goodness to the grace of his divine Father and not to the extraordinary loving ways of Mary and Joseph might wonder why God entrusted these particular earthly parents with the task of caring for his child. It is quite astonishing that none of Christ's followers have ever raised this question, which could have led to new directions in child rearing. You know, that's a really phenomenal kind of statement. The caring parents of the child Jesus have never served as models. On the contrary, religious manuals generally recommend strict disciplinary measures starting in infancy. Once it is no longer a secret that certain psychological laws are behind this kind of model, once enough parents become aware that preaching love will not nurture the child's ability to love, whereas respect and understanding will, then those who receive this respect and understanding in childhood will no longer be the exceptions and will not have to die a martyr's death. If we also take Herod, and this is an important thing, I think, as a symbol of our own society, we can point to aspects of the story of Jesus that may be used as arguments either for or against traditional child-rearing practices, depending on our own experience. On the one hand, the massacre of the innocents, and on the other, extraordinary parents, servants of their child, who in the eyes of traditional pedagogues would then, of necessity, have become tyrants. Society personified in Herod fears children's vitality and authenticity and attempts to eradicate them. But lived out truth cannot be destroyed even when the officials of church and state take it upon themselves to administer the truth with the intent of eliminating it. Maybe we should all go into the Contragate discussion after that phrase. The repeated resurrection of the truth cannot be suppressed. Again and again, individual human beings affirm and live it. The church as a social institution has continually attempted to prevent this resurrection from taking place. For example, by instigating wars in the name of Christ, or by encouraging parents to use strict coercive measures to deaden their children's feelings in the name of the sacred values of child-rearing, obedience, submissiveness, denial of self. The church's struggle, supposedly an expression of God's will, against children's vitality is renewed daily by training them to be blindly obedient to those in authority and to think of themselves as wicked. This approach is more reminiscent of Herod with his fear of the resurrection of the truth in the child than it is of Jesus with his demonstrated confidence in human potentiality. The hatred rooted in the small child's reaction to this training swells to immense proportions, and the church, in part unconsciously, abets the proliferation of evil which, on a conscious level, it professes to oppose. That's pretty heavy-duty stuff, huh?
I don't like that.
Well, I don't like it either, but I think it's true.
The scripture says that Jesus grew in wisdom and in stature and was subject to his parents.
But her point is not so much the language there. The point is that the parents served the child, though, for the child's needs.
Well, aren't they supposed to?
Yeah, but that doesn't always happen. Beating a child because the child misbehaves is not being very... because the child did something that wasn't approved in the code by the parents.
Well, beating is one thing, but after all, discipline, education is discipline.
She's not talking about healthy, training a child to be a healthy part of society. She's not talking about that normal kind of subtle thing. What she's talking about is the fear that that child may end up being something different than you might coerce it to be.
I think she may be trying to approach the issue of authenticity, yeah, which is like an integration of all these things. And the task of the child has its own task, which I don't think is really developed here, but I think that is the next, maybe the next phase.
Well, don't you think parents are a good authority on many subjects that children know nothing about?
Well, I think Nancy's making quite well is that the child's task is to be their authentic self, and that is often disallowed because the parent will not allow that.
Well, of course, you don't destroy their identity, but you certainly have.
Well, actually, that.
But that happens, they'll see time and time and time and time again. That's what is happening in our society all over.
This word, identity crisis, which teenagers generally have to go through and should go through, didn't come because there wasn't a lack of identity. It's because there is a terrible lack of identity, and it's because it's not a full identity, it's only a part of a self. It's not the whole self, because only a part is allowed to exist, and that part is defined by what the parent wants. That, mm-hmm. So I think that's her point.
Mm-hmm. I think so too. Like I said, I'm just sort of struggling to get this stuff out in some sense. But I think that for the fortunate part of this in the church as well, the good side of this, is that I think, and especially that there has been a great deal of care and attention to the needs of the children, and an allowance, especially lately, of children expressing how they want. I think the way in which Sunday school is being taught in our churches now, and confirmation, and things like that, is giving children a great deal more freedom to match their own authentic self with the authenticity of the gospel. That is, no longer is the child hearing, if you don't believe this, you're going to go to hell. or if you don't memorize this scripture passage, you're never going to be a good Christian. We're not telling, but a lot of us heard that when we were growing up. An
that
awful
takes
lot
away
of people.
From our own task, too.
Yeah, and I think some of the you know, the frustrations. One story I would tell quickly about myself, and I did a wedding at my parish at the end of April, and it was a big wedding. There were a lot of people there, and a woman came up to me who I do not remember at all, and she came up to me, and I, unfortunately, she was not being funny, okay. But I think this is a good example, and I thought it to be interesting. She said to me, she introduced herself, and I can't remember her name. She said very quickly, and she said, "I'm so pleased to be here and to see you doing so well." I said, "Thank you." And she said, "I taught you second grade Sunday school, and you were a terrible child." and walked away. And she was serious. She was serious. And what in reading Alice Munn, thinking about that, you know, I can see, I mean, other people have said that to me being funny. I think I probably was.
This phrase that, the worst unruly child or so forth, grows up to be the best.
Sometimes I can, if there is some allowance. But at the same time, even the child that may be unruly or out of control and difficult, and you try and control it by normal kinds of behavior patterns instead of assessing. When I was in Sunday school, and I was in a wonderful, nurturing, terrific parish, just really outstanding. It's still that way. But just in the times it was, that's what you learned. You had to do it this way.